Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And as always, it's so good to be with you again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. And I want to remind those of you listening on radio that you can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. And today we have a very exciting show. We have Jack Cazaza with us. He is such a fascinating person. And you should know that Cazaza is an internationally honored engineer. The Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers has stated that the American consumer, that's you and me, owe him more than any other person for the development of the electric power grid. And that's a quote. Jack has written a book on our electrical power system. Great insight to the development of the electric power system. And before we get to Jack, I want to tell you that I understand that Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Energy in the Office of Electrical Delivery and Energy Reliability, Patricia Hoffman, is going to address the IEEE Homeland Security Technologies Conference November 13th in Boston, Massachusetts. I understand there's still time to register for that particular thing. But in light of the hurricane that hit the East Coast this past week, this is going to be some pretty vital stuff. And also, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our Fountain of Useless Information, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. All right, now let's dial up our guest. What do you say?
Stand by.
All right, at this time, I'm very excited to have this particular guest with us today. I've heard so much about him through our connections with IEEE, the International, Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers out of Washington, D.C. Tell us about Jack Cazaza, and he's an author and a long member of IEEE and a man with a lifetime of experiences, and has written a new book about the electrical grid, which I think has been long overdue. It has been highly acclaimed, the National Academy of Engineering calling it the development of our national electric grid the most important technical development of the 20th century. So we're so glad to have Jack with us. Welcome to the program, Jack.
Good morning.
And it's so good to have you. Now, what made you decide that you wanted to write this book?
I've grown old, Colonel, and as I grow old, I am less able to keep track of all the things that go on from day to day. But I do have a tremendous well of knowledge, personal contacts, much of which has never been published.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to think that our younger people need to know how this grid was developed, who were the people that did it. So a whole century of work was done, and people, individual linemen, substation operators, company presidents, government officials, there are all kinds of different people involved, some of which doing the work and some doing the policy.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that it'd be good for the younger people to know who these people were, if they were famous, and how they did their work. I also want them to be able to see how the lessons of the past, because we didn't always succeed in the past. We had failures, but we overcame them. How were the lessons of the past learned? How were the results achieved? And some of this knowledge can be very, very useful, I think, for looking at our problems right now, including the things going on in this present election. What should the government do? What should private enterprise do? These are questions that were answered and asked over 100 years and built the world's best power system, made possible the wealth of this country, because the electric power system is the lifeblood of the whole economic system. The fact that we can take a piece of coal in Pennsylvania or some oil down in a well in Texas and turn that into a television broadcast or a radio broadcast like we're doing now, communications, industrial power for all of these things made made possible. The use of electricity in the home for heating and cooling. All of these things made it essential to our way of life as it is today. Without this lifeblood of electric power, we could not exist as we do today. And I wanted people to try to understand how some of this was done and learn from it for the future. That was basically my objective.
Well, Jack, you've been around for more than a year or two, so and you've got vast experience yourself. But to really get into the development of the electrical power grid in the United States, you had to go back long before you were ever born. Did you go back to the time when telegraph was invented, which kind of started the whole system of electrifying the country? I mean, did you research back that far, or when did you pick up the story?
I was aware of that earlier work, but I picked it up at the turn of the century. This is the 20th century, and I start out with things going on in 1915. At that particular time, there were independent telephone systems. If you wanted to be listed on all telephone systems, you would be listed on two or three different systems, and there were duplication. There were things going on, all of which influenced the electric power system. So I started around 1915 with what was going on at that time, when there were a lot of small companies being established. People were beginning to see the benefits of electricity, what could be done with it. And a small system was being established, but small systems had problems raising the money. They had problems operating and providing reliability of service. So I started back then, at the beginning of the century, essentially.
Did you get into at all the warring between Westinghouse and Edison over DC and AC and that sort of thing, or had those decisions already been settled by the time you start your book?
They were still around. I talk about in the book. I have a chapter on Edison and the people who worked for him. The thing hadn't been settled back from the start of the century. There, most people had agreed, but the others still disagreed and used DC. It took time to work it out. In fact, that DC was used for quite a while. Some of the people who worked for Edison that moved it forward with the AC. Edison, when he first first started out, hired a man. He hired Samuel Insull, who was born in England, and came here to act as Edison's personal secretary. And after a while, Insull had gotten to him knowledgeable of the electric power economics and how things worked, that he became convinced that the AC systems that were being proposed by Westinghouse was superior to the DC that were being advocated by Edison. And Insull basically left Edison, and he helped found the Edison General Electric Company, which later became GE. He later on formed the Commonwealth Edison Company in Chicago, and Insull saw the advantages of the AC. The principal one is that you could transmit power further with less losses, and you could do it, change voltages with transformers. This could not be done with DC. So Insull, basically, who worked for Edison, became an instrument in moving to DC, to AC. So that explains the extent to which I discuss it in the book. I try to discuss the things that happened in terms of the people who were involved. Samuel Insull was did a lot of things which affected the future of this country, some good, some bad, and the book describes some of them.
Well, it's going to be a fascinating read. I have absolutely no doubt about that. But tell me this. I mean, there certainly probably was some sort of an argument in the beginning about running these power lines and they're being open to hurricanes and disasters and that sort of thing, and instead putting the lines underground. Does your book cover any of that?
Well, it doesn't cover the economics overhead versus underground. What I tried to cover in this were the people who put these elements of the system together. There are a lot of elements in a power system. There are generators. There are transformers. There are circuit breakers. There are transmission lines. There are cables. There are overhead lines. There are substations. There are all these different pieces. Relays. Protection devices against lightning. All of these different devices had to be put together into a system. The book covers how these pieces were put together, not the development of the individual pieces. That's in a lot of the technical books you read in the library. This covers the welding together of a system that became the world's best power system. After 100 years, led to the excellent economics in the United States.
And this began in 1915, and so you start the book out that way in the very first chapter in 1915. And then would you say then the golden age of this development happened in the 10 or 15 years after that, or that would lead up until 1930?
It took 100 years. It's still changing. Some of us may be biased a little bit. But some of us think some of the things that are happening are changing it for the worse. But the system is still changing. You hear terms like smart grid. What does that mean? What is people going to do with the system? How are they going to put all these things together using the smart grid? How will it affect the reliability? How will it affect the cost? How will it affect the amount of fuel you got to burn? All of these things need to be thought about by the people that put the system together, Colonel.
Well, I've been told by members of IEEE that Westinghouse or Edison could walk into some substation or some electrical plant or something right now today and still recognize much of the equipment that they saw 100 years ago. Are you saying that isn't true, that there's been more dramatic changes than that?
Oh, the equipment itself, a generator is still a generator. Its size, its type, the number of poles it's got, the speed it operates at. What drives it, all of these things can be different. But the generator is still a generator in a power plant. A boiler is still a boiler in a power plant. A gas turbine is still a gas turbine in a power plant. So these things have changed. The individual units have changed. They keep improving those, which is what happens with our radios and televisions and everything we do in our society. They improve it. But they're still there. You can recognize them. I would disagree that you can. If you walk in a power plant, you can say that's a generator and that's a transformer, and you would know it, even though you had little experience in a power plant, because they have similar appearances, size, how the power gets into them and out of them. Things of those kind will be different, but you can still recognize them.
Do you think then that the developments such as a smart grid and some of the other things that we're getting today maybe are not an improvement on what was developed, let's say, by 1940 or 1950? I mean, it's been a pretty reliable system all these years, and we've been able to get back in way of storms and things and get electrical power restored again pretty rapidly. What do you think?
Well, I think new technology comes along. We all know that. Back in the 40s and 50s, we didn't have any digital computers. We did have other forms of analog computers.
Mm-hmm.
But the need has developed as digital computing equipment, the Internet, and how computers work, what they can do, improves. We have to figure out how to use these in the system and putting the system together and operating it and implanting it. We want to use the computer more than we have in the past. Some of us, as far back as 1975, I wrote several technical papers presented in Minneapolis arguing that we need to use the modern computing techniques to get more out of our transmission system. We can operate the transmission system in a manner that will enable us to deliver more power with less losses and less cost. We can do these things. And part of what we're trying to do now is to coordinate the operation of the individual factories, residences, and so on, with the operation of the system. We're trying to connect these things using digital computer techniques. I think there are a lot of people who are trying to make a lot of money out of this who don't know what they're talking about. They don't know how the systems work, and I think that this book might be of some help to them. But it's important that we try to use the latest technology. We have digital computers. We have different ways of analyzing problems and conveying energy and communicating. And one of the things that some of us have held as a dream, Colonel, for a long time. Oh, I can remember back a fellow named Stan Smith out at, I think it was UCLA, who said what we have to learn to do is to solve the problems, to see what would happen before it happens. So if we know it's going to happen, we could keep it from happening. Could you follow the logic on that? Analyze the system. For example, one of the problems of the power system, and the power system is an electrical system and a mechanical system combined. Let me make one other point before I go on. The power system is the largest single machine in the world. It's the largest single machine in the world. In fact, in India, just a few weeks ago, 300 million people were interrupted for up to several days. That is a big machine that takes out that number of people. Well, the idea is to... when you have disturbances where things, transients are happening, things are vibrating, and you don't know what's going to stay in synchronism, what isn't, is to be able to analyze what has happened before it causes the problem. And if the problem is amenable, make quick, fast changes in the system to keep it from spreading. This is what some of us have thought about for a long time. That's been a dream. And I do know that back about 1975, stability calculations, these are the calculations if you have a fault, how fast it takes, how long it takes for the generator to trip out. These calculations are made faster than the event would happen. If that's the case, you could go in and maybe open a circuit breaker fast enough to keep the bad things from happening. But that's part of the things we might look at with digital computers and use of new technology. We have to keep using new technology on the power system. I wouldn't say what we did in 1940 was the best. In fact, there are some things we did in 40 have been improved on significantly.
Well, you've said that a lot of people that are doing things with the power system now could really benefit from reading the book because they could learn a whole lot of stuff. And indeed, Tate Publishing, your publishing company, says in the historically accurate Superpower, Jack Casaza tells the story of the 20th century and those who put the technical pieces together to form the world's best electric power system. So, who would be the audience for the book? Is it a neophyte like me who finds a history interesting, or is it the technical person who really wants to be able to get in and fiddle around with the power grid and to make it better? Who's your audience?
Well, one of my I've been married 64 years, Colonel, and my wife and I, she helps me a lot. I have to admit that. I asked her to read it. Did she find it interesting? She said she did. Part of my audience, I want the general public to understand some of these things. So when politicians get up and say some of these things, they'll know who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't, and find it interesting. I think you would find it interesting, particularly some of the things that went on in political circles, some of the meetings with top government officials. Actual discussions of top government officials and the things they did, members of the Federal Power Commission, members of the Department of the Interior, actually reproduced in the book as part of the book, letters from that caused things to happen, people who objected things, and part of the thing, what I get into a little bit, is who should build all these things? Who should be responsible for putting all these pieces together? Should it be individual companies? Should it be the government? Should the government have a department which is responsible for putting all of these things together? Read what the books, what the people said, what Samuel Gompa said. He was the head of the labor unions at the time. He said he didn't want the government doing it. Mm-hmm. He wanted to have companies doing with whom he could bargain in labor situations. So that impact of the decision, or who should make the decision, is a key factor. So I discuss policy. That should be interested in the general public. When they see names like Joseph Swidler, who used to be secretary, head of the Federal Power Commission under Kennedy mm-hmm. and Johnson, and I see names like some of the others involved in the TVA, Lilienthal, and so on. Their names are in there, their statements are in there, and their policies are in there, and the jobs they had there. As these decisions being made, because decisions in this system, like ours, as big as it was, took hundreds and hundreds of people, and starts at the top with the generals, the people try to set the policies. Mm-hmm. But they come down through the ranks, various levels, and people have to implement them. And what were the problems of implementing some of these things? And what were some of the decisions that were made that didn't make any sense because the people had no background? I read some of the blackout reports that are put out by the government. Some of the writing is excellent, but the people don't ask the right questions. Like, they tell you what happened, but they don't tell you why it happened. That's the key question in my mind. And I think that kind of question is going to be of interest to the average reader, because they can understand that. They may not understand the stability calculation, but they can understand who made the decision that caused the problem, that caused the error. Not the error, but who made the decision that led to it. I think that kind of thing is interesting. Engineers, I think lawyers are going to be interested in this. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that were considered in Congress as possible legislation as this went on. College faculties, I think the book will be of interest to professors in the universities, engineering professors, and public policy professors. I think they'll be interested. Lawyers, I mentioned, public policy professors. Labor unions. I have friends in labor unions. I think people who run labor unions and try to save the lives of their labor workers and try to get good wages for them, they're not evil people. These people are mm-hmm. good people trying to do the right thing, and they had to work with the overall organization. I call it the web of people. It's like an internet web, but it's all these different peoples. Somebody passes a law, somebody else writes a regulation mm-hmm. governing its implication, and so on and so on. And somebody's got to go out and make the studies to apply it.
Yeah.
I go through how this is done. Not so much the technology, but the people who did it and what were their problems. Because lots of times some of us worked on things. At the beginning of my life, I was at a lower level. I did things and my boss didn't agree with them. Well, what do you do then? How do you handle it? And how do you make compromises? One of the big problems that came as we were starting to integrate all these systems, Company A would think, well, if I do this, we're going to save money, but how is it going to affect me? Who's going to get the savings, me or the other guy?
Mm-hmm.
Will the other system be able to come in and ask this from me? These are the kinds of questions that were being asked and went on through the 100 years, on and off, still go on today. People at the board level, I served on the board of a utility. The people at the board level are concerned with what will this do to our system, to our company, to our earnings, to our ability to provide safe wages and our ability to provide the necessary capital to build a system. So, well, I was trying to say...
Well, I've been given the cue. We have to take a break, but we'll be back to expand more on that thought right after this.
Okay. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today? Ooh, will you look at this? Why, it's Senator John Kennedy before he was president from the 1960 campaign.
This administration and this country last year had the lowest rate of economic growth, which means jobs, of any major industrialized society in the world in 1959. And when we have to find 25,000 new jobs a week for the next 10 years, we're going to have to grow more. Governor Rockefeller says 5%. The Democratic platform and others say 5%. Many say 4.5%. The last 8 years, the average growth has been about 2.5%. That's why we don't have full employment today.